Welcome to Europe Calling's 214th webinar. I'd particularly like to welcome the guest panelists we have today, whom you can see and whom I'll introduce in more detail later. And many thanks to Jutta Paulus and her team, who had the idea for this webinar and co-organized it with us. My name is Maximilian Fries, and I'm Executive Director of Europe Calling and will moderate this evening. But before we kick off, a couple of housekeeping announcements. We'll be speaking German and English today so that everyone can understand. We have two interpreters with us this evening, and the interpretation function you will find in the bar at the bottom.
Welcome to this 214th Europe Calling webinar. Today we will speak German and English. If you need English interpretation, please check out little globe in the control panel and choose English. So, und jetzt zeige ich euch kurz auf der Folie.
And now I'm just going to show you a slide setting out the order of speakers this evening. We'll start with opening statements. You'll have all the facts then at your disposal, and we'll be ready for the question and answer session. Now, we'll be doing the question and answer session with questions asked on Slido. And that gives you the chance to rate other people's questions so that we can ask the questions you're really interested in. 1,800 people have registered. We'll never be able to get through all the questions they ask without your help. And so you have the link to the Slido in the chat. Now, obviously, we will at the end be saying to you what you can do, and we will have some views on that, because obviously that's what you're interested in. What can I do personally? Right. With that, as usual, we will be recording this event, and then it will be put on the internet and YouTube as a podcast. That concludes the housekeeping announcements. And I'll move on straight to the first guest, Stefan Scheuer, Chief EU Policy Advocate for ChemTrust, which is a German-British association, which, of course, seeks to protect against chemicals that are dangerous to health. He has his own consultancy, and for 8 years, until 2023, was also a member of the European Chemical Agency's Management Board. So he knows exactly how things work in this field. And obviously, he's a big expert. Over to you, Stefan. Thank you, Max. And thanks to Jutta and Europe Calling in general for organizing this event and inviting me. This is a huge subject. It's become a cause célèbre, and this is an important moment in politics. I hope, too, that you will agree that we have hope that we'll be able to resolve this. It's a huge pollution issue, but we do want to be able to tackle it. I'm providing the first presentation, and I've been asked by Max to show you my slides in English, though I will be speaking German, which is a challenge for me, and I hope I will rise to it. In exchange, Max has given me a bit more time for it. I might at times switch into what we call a Denglish, mixture of German and English. But bear with me. First of all, I'd like to tell you what PFAS are, usually called forever chemicals, as a popular term. Pollution is growing as a result of them, and this is a huge problem. The second point I want to address is the EU way to stop such pollution, what is being done and what they should be doing. The third point I'll address is that we need industry in order to solve what is the worst chemicals pollution crisis ever.
Erstens, PFAS, die Ewigkeitschemikalien, ist eine
PFAS, the forever chemicals, is a group of chemicals. PFAS stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. It's a group of several thousand synthetic chemicals. Man-made chemicals. They have one thing in common, and that is that they have a carbon-fluorine bond, and that carbon-fluorine bond is the strongest bond you can find in chemistry. These substances are then used in many types of consumer and industrial products and processes. Another thing they all have in common is that they are highly persistent. They are not really decomposed in the environment. They build up instead in the environment and our bodies. And practically all of us will find we have PFAS in our bodies. We've been familiar with the problems caused by PFAS for several decades. There were some initial bans, but there were only here and there. But there is now a broad consensus that we need to act fast. The Forever Pollution Project is one conducted by investigative journalists. They've done a great job, and for the whole of Europe, they've actually mapped the pollution hotspots. This gives you a quick look at the map. Obviously, it is constantly being updated. And you will see that this issue affects all parts of Europe, but particularly the industrialized regions. PFAS represent major threats to all. There's a long list of possible serious effects on human health, long-term effects, and effects that cannot be reversed or remedied. We also, at present, have a huge problem with drinking water. It's not the only major problem, but we're in the process of losing access to natural drinking water. The concentrations are growing, and so are concerns, as are concerns about the effects on health. Removing PFAS from water is extremely difficult. Not all can be removed, particularly the very short chain ones. However, you can considerably reduce the concentration with expensive technologies, particularly reverse osmosis. And as we know, reverse osmosis is also used for seawater desalination, particularly in certain countries like Saudi Arabia. But that means that drinking water is becoming a scarce and industrial commodity. There are very, very few natural sources left, and that will then impact on water bills. I will see these rising. In Europe, the annual water supply bills will increase by 18 billion euros in total. And depending on where you are, this represents a more or less 25% increase in the water supply bills. The total cleanup costs, looking at Europe, which covers not just drinking water, but wastewater, and also the hot spots I showed you on the map earlier, will amount to considerably higher sums. Annually, these are estimated at 100 billion euros, and they will continue while PFAS are still entering the environment. Right, what is the EU doing to stop the pollution? Well, we have a ban process and a restriction process. It's called the Universal PFAS Restriction under the existing legislation. But Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, and Sweden submitted a proposal in 2023 to ban the entire group of PFAS, but with transition periods of up to 13 and a half years for many uses, to allow time for substitutions to be found and applied so that alternatives can be placed on the market and brought into use. There would also be exemptions for several applications, like medicinal products, for which there are no alternatives. The central player in all of this is the European Chemicals Agency, ECHA. And since 2023, it has been assessing the proposal made by the five countries I mentioned. And the opinion of its independent expert committees are expected in 2026.
eintritt, dann ist die Europäische Kommission am Zug.
When that happens, then the European Commission will have to step in and publish a draft decision. And the legal deadline for adoption will be 3 months after its publication, but very often it takes years. After that, the member states will have their turn and will give their opinion. And then at the end of the process, the Commission has to make a decision. So it will be a long road. ECHA, the European Chemicals Agency, has explained it all very well, and we can see it summed up on this slide. You see here the process in ECHA. This is the biggest dossier it's ever dealt with, and they're looking at groups of applications and products, working their way through them in meetings. They're listed here, and as you can see, it extends over a period of years, having started in June 2024, and it will end sometime this year, and then opinions will be summed up and published. But the EU has further plans. They're looking at revising, reach the EU's chemical safety regulation, which is a regulation that dates from 2006. It's never been updated since then. So it is an aging regulation. And in fact, it has failed to address and prevent the PFAS pollution scandal. This is something that needs to be addressed, and the EU has decided it will try and propose a draft for its amendment this year. Very often, if no data are supplied, the assumption may be that there is no problem. But we've got to change that and say, right, if there's no data, analyzed data, then a product shouldn't actually be even put on the market. Usually in the past, under this regulation, one chemical was tackled at a time. But with a group of several thousand substances, it takes far too long and very little progress is made. And it also, of course, kills the right kind of innovation. What happens is that people then just turn to the next substance that is not covered by the restriction or ban. And so we're going to have to start tackling things in groups, as is happening with PFAS. The other thing is that we've got to get much faster at tackling the most dangerous substances, which are highly persistent, which have effects that cannot be reversed. And we've got to get them banned as fast as possible and in as unbureaucratic a way as possible. That brings me to my final point. We need the industry if we're to solve what is the worst pollution crisis of our times. We need timely information from the industry saying where the substances are applied, what alternatives are being developed, and we need constructive help to find the solutions and stop PFAS pollution as quickly as possible and reduce their use to zero. Unfortunately, at present, the chemicals industry is concentrating at the moment on defending the current use of PFAS, often based on false claims. But Vicky will address this later. But we also need the chemicals industry to advance the revision of the REACH regulation and in order to protect the single market. At present, you have PFAS bans in Denmark, France, they're in the pipeline, but of course, what happens to the single market if no care is taken? And that's why we need to ensure the REACH regulation is revised and that we get the general protection at a uniform level. Again, industry, instead of helping, is trying to stop or delay the revision and is free-riding on the fears of economic decline or economic issues and recession. I think it's important to recognize here that however important the chemicals industry is, It's really only a service provider providing substances for products which very often could be produced with other substances or without those substances. So there's a lot of scaremongering going on. And finally, we can solve the crisis if we work together. But we've got to work fast. We don't have much time left if we want to save our resources and the current health standards. Thank you, Stefan. Well, I think you rose in a masterly way to the challenge of giving your presentation in German. Now, you referred to Vicky Kahn. She's a researcher and campaigner for Corporate Europe Observatory, an NGO. And she was involved too in the Forever Lobbying project, which was also mentioned by Stefan. She was very actively involved in it, was one of the co-authors. Those of you who have attended various Europe Calling webinars will be familiar with Vicky. There are very few people who know their way around the lobbying circles better than Vicky, which is why it's a pleasure to welcome you here. And I look forward very much to your presentation. Go ahead, Vicky.
Thank you very much. It's brilliant to be with you today. And as you just heard, I'm going to talk about the PFAS corporate lobby. But a word or two about Corporate Europe Observatory. As Max said, we've been going for a long time researching and campaigning to expose and stop corporate influence in EU decision making. And we work on a number of different issues, chemicals just being one of them. I really want to talk to you today about PFAS, as we've been hearing, and two elements of perhaps the publications that you will have seen last week. The first one being the publications of the Forever Lobbying Project. This is an extension of the project that Stefan mentioned, which was the map of the Forever Pollution Project that was published a few years ago. This second element has particularly focused on lobbying. It's been led by Le Monde in France, and it included 29 different media outlets in 16 countries. And they had three key strands of work. The first one is something that Stefan alluded to, which is some detailed calculations and analysis of the costs of PFAS cleanup at the environmental level. And I think Stefan already used this figure of it will be at least 100 billion per year in perpetuity, unless we tackle forever pollution. The second element of this project, launched by journalists last week, was to stress test industry's arguments around why we need PFAS and why they must continue to produce PFAS. And I will explore that a little bit more in a minute. And then the third element was something that we, as Corporate Europe Observatory, was very much involved in, that was collecting lobby documents and other information about PFAS and putting them into a huge archive, the biggest archive now in the world on PFAS. It has lobby documents, documents from legal cases and other information on PFAS, particularly documents from industry. And it is all now hosted in this web link. And I urge you to explore the Forever Lobbying Project's website. And indeed, these 14,000 documents that have been collected. But a word or two, first of all, about the work that the journalists did to look at the arguments that the PFAS industry uses to try and justify the ongoing production of PFAS, the ongoing use of PFAS in our chemical and in our consumer and in our industrial products and substances and processes. And the journalists did something which I think is very unusual for journalists, but was very, very welcome, in that they took a deep look at the industry arguments to justify PFAS. And they worked with independent scientists and independent academics to assess how rigorous and how real the arguments of industry are. And there's not time today to go through all of the findings. Again, I urge you to look at the website. But just from this snapshot, you can see that the journalists ended up dismissing a lot of the arguments that industry uses to justify PFAS. They said they were misleading, that some were false, and that really the lobby campaign is based on a lot of industry spin. And this is a really, really important finding, because we increasingly see how much these industry arguments are being adopted by decision makers at the EU level, but also at the member state level, including in Germany and other countries across the EU. So the work that the journalists have done to deep dive into these arguments and to show the reality of them, I think is extremely, extremely welcome. But now I'll just say a few words about our own contribution and our own publication from last week. We published at the same time as the Forever Pollution project, and we looked in particular at the EU level industry campaign against the universal PFAS restriction. And we looked in particular at the role of the Commission, because as Stefan said, at the moment, the restriction, the PFAS restriction, is with the Chemicals Agency, and the Commission is really in an observer role. But nonetheless, it is being very active in talking with industry, and I will mention some more about that in a minute. But first of all, let's have a look at the big PFAS producers and users from the chemicals industry, and exactly how they have been active on trying to slow down, to limit, or to even derail the proposed PFAS restriction. Not all lobbies are acting in the same way, but of course you would expect that the chemicals industry would be very active on such a big proposal as the PFAS one. But nonetheless, we found that taken as a group, these big PFAS producers and users from the chemicals industry have increased just in the past year on all topics their declared spending on EU lobbying by at least 34%, at least a third, if not by more. And I think that in that figure just alone, I think, gives you an idea of how much PFAS producers and polluters are increasing their efforts to try and stop and weaken the PFAS proposal. And we particularly in our report highlight the role of the company Chemours. You may or may not have heard of Chemours. It's a spin-off from the US company DuPont. Its EU headquarters is in Switzerland. And it is a major producer of a particular kind of PFAS, which are the plastic PFAS called fluoropolymers. And our investigation showed that Chemours has had more high-level commission meetings on PFAS than anybody else, and indeed more than all NGOs put together. We can see that they are relying quite heavily to run their lobby campaign on using lobby and PR companies and also law firms. Been very important, I think, in their campaigning. They have done something that we often see industry doing, which is to promote weaker or voluntary industry schemes as a way of distracting from the benefits of actually having a tough EU level regulation. And we have seen that they have really worked to mobilize their industry allies to get active on PFAS. And what do I mean by that? Well, of course, it is not just the PFAS producers themselves that have an interest in this regulation. PFAS, as we've heard, are used in many different sectors. And when we looked at the lobbying that was happening, Chemours had been very effective in trying to mobilize its supply chains. And together with other industry lobbies, from the chemicals industry. We can see that the battery sector, for example, used in electric vehicles, medical technology, chip manufacturers, and many other sectors have also been mobilized to be active on PFAS. And this, we have found this challenging and problematic because of the spin and the false and misleading arguments that some of the lobbyists, some of the industry lobbyists have been using. But nonetheless, that hasn't stopped the Commission from listening to these lobbies. And we see that actually this spin campaign and the heavy efforts that industry is making is already seeming to have an impact on the Commission. We worry that the Commission is listening to industry and responding as they would wish. For example, we can see that the Commission is giving many meetings to industry, providing access, privileged access, you can argue. We can see that they are offering help and advice to lobbies on how to get their voice heard, perhaps by other Commission departments. And we have seen in the lobby correspondence between the Commission and companies and trade associations that there are some very warm words, very encouraging words for industry about potential opt-outs or derogations, which is what industry is ultimately after. When we did a survey of 15 different commission departments within the EU's executive, we found that the EU doesn't have any specific rules in place on the PFAS proposal to protect itself from this industry lobbying. And we find that particularly problematic when we recognise the history of chemical industry lobbying at the EU level in diluting and weakening proposals. There's a history of this. ChemSec produced something on this just last week. And considering the reputation and the background of industry, that we think it is problematic that the Commission hasn't already put in place some specific rules to protect the decision making on this. And indeed, when we looked at the transparency tools as well that the Commission has at its disposal, we also felt that they were very much lacking, and there was not the ability to really hold industry to account for its lobbying. So in conclusion, we say that we need to reclaim regulation as a really effective way of tackling environmental pollution, tackling health concerns, and that we really do need, of course, a strict ban on forever chemicals and much more effort to be put into safer, finding the safer alternatives, getting them to the market and promoting them. And I know Teresa will say much more on that. But looking at what we can already see about the chemicals industry campaign, what we know about how they have operated in the past, we also think it's time to change the way in which the Commission handles lobbying. And we think they should be restricting the way in which chemicals industry is able to lobby, to be limited to public consultations, public moments of communication with the Commission in order to enable public interest decision makings to prevail. And indeed, 100 NGOs or so today have written to von der Leyen with these and some other similar recommendations. I only have 10 minutes, so I will pause there. Thank you very much for your attention. I really look forward to your questions afterwards. Thank you.
Vielen Dank, Vicky. Ja, wirklich, wirklich großartig.
Thank you very much, Vicky. That was great.
Was ihr da geleistet habt mit so vielen Organisationen zusammen.
It's great what you've done with so many different organizations. On the questions, we've already received an awful lot of very good questions. I'll keep looking at questions as they come in while the other speakers are speaking. But it's great to have so many great questions already. Right, thank you very much. We'll now move on to Theresa Kjell, who is head of ChemSec's chemicals policy. That's the International Chemicals Secretariat. It works inter alia with large groups, investors, to bring an end to the use of toxic chemicals. She's familiar with the world of chemicals from the point of view of regulators, but also of the industry, because she's a member of the Apple and Lego Green Chemistry Advisory Boards. So she's working with the large groups that we need to address. Looking forward to what she has to say. Theresa, over to you.
Thank you so much. Can you see my presentation well? Okay, great. First of all, I just want to thank you for organizing this event. It's really interesting, and I'm very happy to have been invited. See if I can shift here. Yes, great. Just to recap a bit, I mean, PFAS is a global pollution problem of unimaginable magnitude. It is truly a forever chemical. It's present on the whole planet and in every baby being born. And we never agreed to this. It is a violation of our rights. But it also has huge economic aspects. So phasing out PFAS is costly for industry that relies on the production or use of it. Of course it is. That's always the case. But the pure economic benefits for society as a whole widely outweighs the cost for those specific companies to phase it out. This is really important to keep in mind. And I also read the other day the Global Risk Report 2025 from the World Economic Forum, and they too highlight the PFAS problems. They too are very concerned and recognize that this is a global risk. Their role is to support decision makers in balancing current crisis and longer term priorities. So even financially, there is really no way around phasing out PFAS. So as an environmental organization with extensive collaboration with both companies and investors, of course, I want to share their perspective here. Companies, brands, they have had PFAS as their number one chemical issue for years. They've been struggling to actually get the information on where PFAS is used in their own products and production. And this is surprisingly difficult. And I want to emphasize that we have discussions with an incredible amount of companies. It's not just the companies in the ChemSec business group that we're talking about. This is global. It is very difficult for them to even find out where this group of chemicals is used in their products. And then comes the efforts to phase it out, but many have come a long way. It is a process, but the PFAS restriction dossier that Stefan talked about earlier was a real game changer in this work. It is the perfect example of how regulation drives innovation. The mere anticipation of this restriction has opened up both information about the uses, but also the search and find for PFAS-free solutions. In our work, it's clear that phasing out PFAS is, in fact, a business opportunity. So, in the discussions about how to get out of this mess, many stakeholders call for the need for investments. And we at ChemSec, we have a network of 70 institutional investors holding $18 trillion asset under management. And they are engaged in the chemical issue. And for chemicals, PFAS is the number one priority for them too, because of, for example, the risk of litigation costs. And by the way, we see a similar trend for insurance companies that they become less willing to insure against PFAS pollution related costs. So what about the availability of alternatives. And just to clarify, this restriction proposal that we are talking about, it actually is about restricting the uses where there are no alternatives available. If there are alternatives available, you should not be getting a derogation. That's just the principles that we have to deal with at the moment, important to keep in mind. And there is so much misinformation being spread in media at the moment about what does and doesn't work. And Vicky has just told us much about that. So therefore, we at ChemSec have dedicated ourselves to really find this out by gathering existing information, producing studies, and having countless of conversations with alternatives providers around the world. And in front of you, I have a brief summary of what we have found. So at the bottom right, we have most of the consumer products, and they are basically a done deal. It's maybe of less importance as these volumes are generally lower, but we still need to phase everything out because, you know, this is the only way to tackle the problem. Textiles is a bit higher up. This is a use category where there is surprisingly high use still, even though we know that there are plenty of alternatives available and has been for years. So this really shows the need for regulation. The fact that alternatives are available is not enough to shift the use. It won't happen voluntarily. So basically, the whole consumer product category is an easy fix. Nobody serious is really opposing that at the moment. But then we have categories like F-gases. That's high up on the, in the green column there. F-gases are responsible for 63% of all emissions of PFAS. Very important. And there are alternatives available for almost all of these uses, like heat pumps for heating your house, mobile air conditioning for electric vehicles, or submersion cooling of data centers that we need for using AI. But the narrative that this is not possible is still being spread. If you look at the purple box, you will find a number of medium volume uses that have solutions but still need work to replace PFAS uses. And then we have the orange box. That's interesting. Here we have uses that are currently quite low volumes and relatively low availability of alternatives. It's not true for all the users, but generally. And here we see an incredible innovation speed. And we also know that many of these users will be scaled up in the future, so they will become increasingly important. And companies that are able to find solutions in these fields have a great potential to thrive, provided that the derogations are relevant. So what do we need to incentivize the development that we so desperately need so that we can transition into a situation that doesn't make the PFAS pollution worse? Our analysis, based on thorough policy work, discussions with alternatives providers and investors, shows the following. Predictability is crucial. The EU needs to follow through on this restriction as it is, follow the democratic process that we have and give relevant time-limited derogations for the users that cannot do without. And this will be key for investments and development of solutions that are future-proof, resilient and competitive, staying ahead of other markets in the world. It gives the business case both for brands and alternatives providers to take that step to push suppliers and attract investments. It will provide a level playing field as the restrictions also cover imported articles and that they are the same for all. And very important to remember is that focusing on only consumer product doesn't cut it. It is far from enough. It gives the image of action, when in fact it is the opposite, slowing down the phase out of the really important and challenging uses. So this ban needs to be horizontal and only allow continued uses for the functions where it is truly necessary. And this is how we get the EU ahead, securing resilience, competitiveness, showing leadership while marking the beginning of the end of this global pollution crisis. Thank you so much. Looking forward to the questions.
Ja, danke dir. Ich kriege schon Nachrichten von, boah, was waren das denn für zwei Präsentationen? Das hat man ja wirklich mal alles verstanden.
I'm getting messages that people really have understood all that. So, congratulations to you all.
Das ist nicht normal bei dem Thema.
You're really getting people tied in here. Not to be necessarily expected with this subject. Now we're going to hear from our final guest speaker, Jutta Paulus. She's currently in Strasbourg because she's a member of the European Parliament. And this is her second parliament. She's a Green MEP and she's a pharmacist and she used to have her own testing lab too. So, I think that you ought to know that Jutta Paulus was last year ranked one of the 8 best MEPs, particularly for her work on the nature restoration plans. So I'm looking forward to what she has to say and hearing what the EP is planning. Thank you very much for your kind introduction, Max. I don't have a PowerPoint presentation to show you, I'm afraid, but of course I very much enjoyed the wonderful presentations of the 3 previous speakers, which I listened very carefully to. I think that you presented the issues extremely well, and in particular, the real issue is the persistence of these substances. They do not decompose in the environment because of the bond that such substances provide. And with practically all these substances, we find we're above the threshold where toxicological effects or endocrine disruptor effects can be seen. When REACH was adopted in 2006, at a time when I wasn't yet in politics, but I was running my laboratory, we had a lot of data surveys, and we were also involved in research and following up research. And I know that the pharmaceutical industry did a lot of surveys, and particularly with small and medium-sized producers. And even back then, it was noted with dismay that a lot of the deadlines by which data had to be supplied were not met. And Stefan has shown you in his presentation how REACH works. If you want to be able to use these chemicals or sell them in the EU, you have to supply the data on them in order to get them registered. And in the REACH regulation, there were certain deadlines. People had to supply data on how many thousand tons a year they would be producing and so on. And they had to supply that data by certain deadlines. Sometimes people found, the deadline is the 31st of May, say, I still don't have some data, and they would contact us, say, mid-April, asking us to do tests. My response was often, you should have come to us earlier, because otherwise we'll have to work every weekend in order to meet the deadlines, and it won't work. Oh, they said, in that case, we'll send in an incomprehensible file because it's for REACH. And that meant we had the problems Stefan mentioned. Obviously, the big producers produce raw data and they can mobilize users. But the problem is the resistance. The substances remain in the environment for a long time. They have a toxicological effect, they're carcinogenic, they're quite damaging, say, for the fetus. But they can also have endocrine disruptor effects, effects on the thyroid, for instance. And that can mean that a lot of young couples find it hard to conceive and become pregnant. I'd also like to comment now on some of the points made by Vicky about lobbying. If you remember how the process goes, you have a proposal to restrict, which was sent to the Chemicals Agency and is now going through their committees, who will work out their opinions. And at the end of the day, the Commission will produce a proposal on which the Member States will then negotiate. How about the Parliament? It's not involved, which means the Parliament plays no role whatsoever. It has no formal role in this process. But that doesn't mean that people aren't approaching us. I've received an awful lot of emails and requests for conversation and proposals from users or producers, all of whom claim that these substances are irreplaceable and essential in their process. To be honest, though, I have to tell you that there are applications where I, with my scientific background, know that there are no alternatives that can be used easily. On a very small scale, we conducted various processes looking at alternative substances at high temperatures. And basically, it's not possible to apply them. If you were to, however, try an alternative, I think that it might be difficult to provide them with the same reliability and ceteris paribus. So we may have to allow the possibility, in my opinion, in the proposal of saying, right, okay, the deadline will be, say, so and so many months, and we'll allow you so many months to see whether there is a proper alternative. But if not, we will have to be perhaps generous, but we'll also have to be strict with the fluoropolymers. People keep saying that they're harmless. Teflon in itself is harmless, but it has to be produced, doesn't it? And it's in the production. And at the end of its life, where it may land in an incinerator or somewhere else, you then have the problem that that fluorinated polymer, which is extremely resistant, a substance, cannot be disposed of mechanically. Will have to be stored in long-term processes in various facilities. Now, what does that mean? With my colleagues, and luckily across the different political groups, I have a lot of people on my side, so we will continue to put pressure on and put pressure on the Commission so that as soon as possible, where we have alternatives, particularly in consumer products, but not just in consumer products, we make it very clear that there will be no forever exemptions, and the Commission should, as soon as possible, propose a revised REACH regulation, taking account of all this. Because these substances existed when REACH was negotiated. And in its current form, the REACH regulation has not been sufficient to protect our populations against these substances. At the end of the day, of course, we will need better limit values. Fortunately, finally, in the EU drinking water legislation and in German legislation, we now have some limit values. But it still means that producers can still produce wastewater with high concentrations of PFAS and dispose of it. So we need action. And in my political group, I and my colleagues have started a petition where we're asking you to join us in calling on the Commission to do its job of protecting the health and well-being of European citizens and to actually implement what I've just outlined to you and present the relevant legislative proposals. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jutta. Right, we've got a good half hour now for what are very many questions. We'll do it as follows. I'll speak German, but you can answer in whichever language you wish. I'm going to call up a number of questions, and here in Zoom you can use the raised hand function. And if you do so, then I'll give you the floor, because, of course, we don't have to hear from every speaker and every question. One person may have taken care of everything that has to be said in reply to it. That means we can get through more questions, perhaps. Right. I'd like to start right at the top, which is from Jennifer. And I think it's probably for Jutta Paulus. Jennifer asks, why haven't we banned the toxic fluoropolymers? Yes, as has been said, such substances cannot simply be banned overnight. People simply cannot stop their use overnight, certainly not overnight, particularly in medicinal products. The fact is that we not only have to find substances which have the same properties, which you'd like them to have, which don't have the same effects on the body, but which have also gone through the admission process before they're then used in medicinal products. I've talked to Robert about it several times myself, and of course, as an economics minister, you do have some idea of the needs of business and the mood in business, but we both agree that where there are alternatives, we cannot allow their continued use. We're also very much agreed that we urgently need more research, particularly in those areas where at present we don't have any really good alternatives. You remember what Teresa said, and that the chain effect should. I was once at an event where this was the question that arose. And obviously, quoting one sentence is different to hearing an entire presentation, but the aim is that we tackle this in such a way that we come up with a reasonable way of eliminating these PFAS from our future lives. And I shall certainly leave no stone unturned in ensuring that that happens. Thank you. And on Sunday, the Robert Habeck Party will be discussing this, and they'll be discussing what they'd be in agreement with for their campaign, and that would also include the elimination of the use of PFAS. So I hope that that can be defended. Stefan, you wanted to come in. Yes, just a brief comment on that point. Obviously, part of industry's strategy with the misleading arguments and false claims was to say that the polymeric PFAS are of no concern, and the OECD has used a definition of them, and in fact, it doesn't even exist. So that was really quite cheeky of industry to try and attract ministers and other decision makers. I just wanted to add that at this stage. Yes, it's an important point. And it'll involve Vicky, I think, because I think basically the aim that through the admissions procedure of chemicals, it shouldn't be possible to allow industry studies or research that has been paid for or produced by industry. They shouldn't be allowed. And we failed to get that point across properly in the past, I think, but perhaps you could comment on the role of such research and assessments conducted by industry. I think you need to know what it means for regulators.
Yes, I think this is a really important point, because I think in the deep dive that the Forever Pollution Project did into industry claims, and indeed our own look at the lobbying that's happening, we can see that there is a real risk that industry science is going to pollute the regulatory process. There are a couple of articles that articles which have been used and repeated many, many times by industry in submissions to the Chemicals Agency and have been sent to the Commission many, many times, making particular claims about the low concern of particular kinds of PFAS. But these scientific articles have been written by industry players, that they're named on them and they funded them, and they're written by industry staff. And this is, I think, part of the problem of much of what industry has been saying. There is some misleading claims being put out, and politicians are too ready to accept them. So industry needs to be able to put its viewpoints forward, but it is very, very important that the scientists within the Chemicals Agency are able to then step back and look at this very, very logically and from an independent scientific basis, and to be able to see through the claims. And our worry is that the ongoing lobbying is polluting that scientific process.
Thank you, Vicky. Jutta meldet sich.
Yes, Vicky. Now, Jutta. Yes, I'd like to add something on this. Obviously, as a self-employed lab owner, we conducted such studies for which we were paid by industry, and I too received phone calls sometimes. And obviously, they would ask, well, can this be put a different way? And when I took a look at the results and thought, no, it can't be done, I said, no. But where things can be put differently, you're under pressure to do so. I can imagine that you have people in labs who might feel under pressure to do that. But the other thing that isn't on is that you commence such a study, you do a couple of preliminary tests, and then you have to keep looking at what you've been asked to do, and you get back to them and say, well, you'd like to do it at such a different concentration. And then you're told, oh, no, stop. And you ask why, and they say, oh, well, it looks a bit silly. We're not going to submit it at all anymore. And that's no longer allowed. So such people who commission tests have to submit them now to ECHA. So this remains an issue. And obviously, if authorities were to commission studies, that would be a great solution. But then you'd have to increase the staff and resources of the authorities, because they have to take care of this, and then they have to look at the results and then decide on that basis. So that should not be underestimated. In small and medium-sized companies, they often farm out to other companies, but the cost of what they need is very, very expensive. Yes, I think it's Teresa.
I'll be extremely brief considering the time, but I, of course, I agree that there is plenty of studies out there that are problematic and incorrect. And I think you always have to look at who funded it and who is actually gaining something from this when you evaluate. But I also want to give some credit to ECHA and the committees and the work that they are doing, because we are an accredited stakeholder. We are part of all these meetings where you go through the dossier use by use, and they do a thorough work and they put their heart and soul into this. And I mean, it's tough, but it is a process that is going forward. So really, I want to give them credit and rely on that process. I think we can trust in that. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Danke dir. Ich glaube auch, also
thank
was du
you.
Sagst, ein bisschen das, was man schon sieht, was der jahrelange Druck auch
Well,
gebracht hat, ist ja auch,
obviously,
dass wir zum
one
Beispiel
result of the
jetzt
pressure over many years
kritisiert ja auch ihre Lobbytreffen, weil unterhalb der
The new commissioner is now publishing lobbying meetings at levels far below that of commissioner. So directors and other officials who are actually doing the work, they are now being lobbied. But for many years, civil society had to put on a lot of pressure in order to get this to happen. With lobby transparency, though Vicky may disagree, I have the feeling that things have got better. It may not yet be at the level it should be, but as regards lobby transparency, things have got a bit better. And the new president of the council has also now announced that his people will be transparent about the lobbying, which they refused to date. So I have a feeling it's getting better. But Vicky, how do you see?
Yes, there has been a lot of improvements in the last, I mean, I've been working with Corporate Europe Observatory for 15 years or so, and we can see improvements in lobby transparency at the EU level and probably at the member state level as well. But it is very limited and it is very slow. And there have been recent improvements in the transparency of lobby meetings in the Commission, for example. But that has only taken us from lobby transparency for 400 officials to now 1,500 officials, which is great, except that there are about 30 or 40,000 officials working in the Commission. So we are still looking at transparency for a very small percentage of them. So there is much more work to be done. But I would also really want to emphasize that transparency is not enough. Transparency tells us what's going on, but it doesn't help us to really tackle the privileged access, the imbalance in the meetings. And as I say, it doesn't help us to really tackle the problem of misleading corporate lobbying that we're particularly seeing here. So transparency, I always think of as a cornerstone for really good public interest decision making, but not enough. We need many more procedures and processes in place to really have proper accountability and to get the decisions at the end of the day that I think we deserve as citizens.
Da will ich direkt nachfragen, das hast du in deinem Talk ja auch schon gesagt.
Yes, perhaps I could come back on this. In concrete terms, what would the end of privileged access actually mean? You mentioned the fact that industry is consulted, but perhaps it wouldn't apply to all trade associations. So what would ending it mean? Let's hear from Vicky first, then Stefan.
So we very much take our lead from looking at the tobacco and fossil fuel sectors, because if you look at the tobacco sector, for years there was misinformation. There was a product in cigarettes and tobacco that was known to create harm, and a sense that regulators could not stand up enough to industry and get the regulations in place to serve the public interest. And so then the World Health Organization, recognizing this problem and specifically recognizing the problem of the tobacco lobby, said we need a different approach. And now the World Health Organization has rules in place. We call it a firewall approach, if you like, which says that the tobacco industry should not be involved involved in lobbying when it is on public health matters, because they have nothing to contribute to the public interest on public health. And those rules have cascaded down over time and are adopted by almost all member states, almost all countries around the world now, as I understand it. It hasn't entirely stopped the power of the tobacco lobby, of course not, but it has been an important step. And I think we can see the impacts of that, because certainly in the UK, and I think in other countries as well, there is now a much tougher regulation in place to tackle smoking and to tackle the harms of tobacco. And we think that this is an approach that could be taken and adopted to other sectors. Fossil fuels is another obvious one, where we know that there has been this actually very similar history from tobacco to fossil fuels in terms of the kind of lobbying that they have led, and the urgent need to tackle climate crisis. And also, we think it could apply to the toxics industry as well. Again, there has been a history of misleading lobbying, and and we can see the harms of industry. That's not to say that industry never has a say, of course not. That is not what we are saying. But it is about finding a way to leave decision makers free to be able to take public interest decisions, to have information from industry, but in ways which do not embark upon privileged access and lobbying, which is based on misleading information and which cannot be countered by public interest groups. So we call it a firewall approach, and ultimately this is our vision for how we would like to see regulation of the toxic sector.
Danke dir. Dann Stefan.
Thank you. Then Stefan. And then we'll see where we are.
Let me continue that in English, maybe. It's a flowing on conversation now, which is really great. There's an element which I want to stress, which is, of course, the European Commission is here the most important player when we look, for example, at the PFAS restriction, because at the end, the Commission has been empowered to decide. Now, the Commission is inherently a political body, and it has become even more so with presidents starting earlier on, but also now with von der Leyen, very much so. So I think there is a bit of a politicization going on in the Commission, which is, of course, difficult for such a PFAS restriction process, which we would like to see in the hands of experts. much control there. So, but I think here we are in an issue where there's things have come out of balance, in particular with regard to ECHA, the European Chemicals Agency. It should be the place where the expertise independently is provided. and we are knowing that ECHA's setup, which happened through the REACH regulation, isn't perfect. It has a very complex budget system. The nomination of its people is complicated. And we're waiting for a while now for the Commission to produce a new founding regulation for ECHA to strengthen it, to make its governance stronger, its independence, to produce opinions which, are truly a powerful basis for then the decision makers later. And we are waiting on that, in particular knowing that this is held back by the department in the Commission, which is working on the economic side, DG Grow it's called. It's sort of the economy ministry, if you want, of the European Commission. And they have been delaying that. And that's very, very annoying. And we are really trying to see how this can accelerate, how we can get that out to really make sure we strengthen ECHA and therefore have a better chance of robust decisions at the end of the day.
Dankeschön. Dann
thanks very much. Right, I'm now going to take three questions, and again, we can repeat the raised hand process. The first of these is from Dorothea. She asks about the blades of wind turbines with 30,000 wind farms in Germany shed PFAS. And if the harmfulness is known, why are such substances not banned from the outset in futuristic technologies? And then Carl asks, is there some overview of the consumer goods contaminated with PFAS and are produced or are still being produced? This is an important question which arises again and again about labeling, purchase decisions. I've sometimes tried in the past to buy a PFAS-free frying pan, and it's not that easy. So that was Carl's question. And Gabriele Müller asks, why isn't the onus or burden of proof reversed so that the industry has to prove that new substances are not harmful to health? I suppose it's the taken care procedure. Well, let's start with Jutta. Yes, I wanted to say something about the wind farms. This is not the first time I've been asked about this. And in fact, it's from an angle who don't really care much as usually about that toxic nature of chemicals. But the blades of wind turbines are usually made of synthetics, and there might be polymers, but I don't think in huge quantities. Possibly there might be fluorinated polymers in some of them with less shedding than others. But if you look at the entire spread, and I remember with the air quality directive, I looked into this, and not the industry, but the science field itself came up with a quantity of about 1,500 tons of a small particle dust, which is shed by the rotary blades, some of which would be PFAS. If you then compare that with the friction of tires, it's quite negligible. The major sources of PFAS in our environment are, in my view, first of all, the wastewater issue, where there are no limit values, as I've said. Secondly, pesticides, which are sprayed on a large scale to narrow the PFAS themselves or contain the PFAS, particularly trifluoroacid. And of course, you have in disposable products to a large extent such PFAS as well. Anything that's coated in such a way that it's resistant to dirt, grease, and fats. So I think that actually the wind turbines are one of the least of our problems. Yes, Teresa.
Yeah, specifically about the what products contain PFAS. I mean, wind turbines, that is one of them. Where you can find especially the fluoropolymers, but not in all wind turbines. So clearly there are possibilities to produce those, maybe not entirely without, I could not claim that, but for many of the uses in a wind turbine. And this is a very important point to make, that when you look at the PFAS use, some of these uses may be very difficult to phase out and some may be quite easy. And that is why you have to look at the actual function of PFAS and not make a derogation for wind turbines or for batteries or for a whole sector, but to actually say that fine, for the cathode binder in a lithium ion battery, we can accept a derogation for a number of years, but not for the other parts. That is very important, because otherwise, if you do the generalization when it comes to the derogations, you completely destroy the market for the alternatives providers for those solutions that are already available. So that is very important to state. And in general, there is some information and there is increasing information about where in different types of products, also consumer products, we have PFAS. And most of that information comes from the actual dossier provided by the five states. So it's very difficult to find, and we have tried to summarize it as well as we can as a help to companies in particular, because we don't think it should be up to consumers to have that type of knowledge. That is absolutely impossible. And there is no labeling. There is no requirement to put that on a product. So it's really something that a consumer shouldn't be have to be concerned about. But the information is partly there, increasingly so. And the third question was, why is it even there to start with? Why hasn't regulation already fixed this? And the reason is what Stefan already went into. The REACH regulation has been in place for almost 20 years, but it hasn't delivered what it intended to do. And I personally don't think there is so much problem with the actual chemicals regulation as such, but more about the implementation of it. The intention is there. You were supposed to have the no data, no market principle in place, but it didn't happen. And that was a question of willingness. And I just hope that there is pressure from people around Europe towards politicians, so that there can be a new revised REACH with stronger legislation and a will to actually not end up in a new PFAS crisis. This is what we need. We need to strengthen both the actual regulation, but also the willingness to implement it in a way that it properly protects human health and the environment and work for industry. Thanks.
Thank you, Stefan.
Yes, well, I mean, the burden of proof, the windmill problems, whatever, the whole thing is about we're in a crisis because we have failed to prevent the pollution. And it's the old story. And now it's amazing because, I mean, because of these properties of PFAS, the users were dreamlike, so it spread wild. It was exponential growth, probably. So we really went deep, deep, deep into huge problem now. So it's quite a mess to step out. That's why I think we really need to see how we pull all together on that and listen less to probably the chemists, but really work with the downstream users, who at the end, you know, would be probably quite happy to move in a new direction and not have to constantly reformulate their products, because that's very expensive, waste time, waste innovation, waste market leadership. So I think the quicker we change the direction, the better for Europe's industry production. And that's definitely not the world of chemists. But, you know, if a company produces PFAS and that's its business, well, you know, okay, it's like the tobacco case. But then the other point is about the REACH. Why didn't it manage to catch it earlier? Why didn't it prevent? And I think there are systemic problems in there, which, you know, Jutta, you have mentioned about, you know, if the industry was required in principle to provide the safety information to be sure that no substance enters the market without being checked for its safety. But when the dossiers are empty and you're not punished for it, I mean, you would be stupid. You would put a lot of money in there for showing that your substance is safe or not safe while the other one just moves on. So it's like it totally got out of balance here. We have also, I mean, I was around when REACH regulation was designed. There were also things put in there which make it difficult, which mean that the authorities have, in a way, the burden of proving that a substance cannot be controlled before they can restrict it. So it was done very difficult for authorities. It's cumbersome. It takes sometimes years, if not decades, for authorities to evaluate whether a substance is actually toxic for certain endpoints and therefore can be restricted. Now we learn we have to move much earlier. We have to look at persistency and bioaccumulation. If the stuff is found in our bodies, in our blood, hell, I don't want to wait 10 years until somebody finds out what damage it actually does, because then it's too late. So I think we need to, that's the systemic problems we need to tackle now in revising the law and really make sure that the burden of proof would be indeed on the ones who actually market these substances.
Jutta, and I give you another
question because Stefan referred to this, and there was a question about more truth being better. You think nothing can be done, but sometimes something can be done. Somebody asked anonymously whether this is not the same situation as we had almost 100 years ago with DDT. And CFCs, more recently, CFCs in refrigerators, for instance, we were told, yes, it was essential, you couldn't do without. And 10 years later, it seemed, yes, you could do without it. So can the PFAS situation be compared with a major crisis we've had in the environment with DDT and CFCs?
Well,
you either have fluorinated products which are so persistent that you can't get rid of. The problem with REACH, though, was as follows. Previously, in Germany, the legislation dated back to 1970, and that was the very first time the industry had to supply data only for new substances. Everything else previously on the market was on the market anyway. So you then had all these new requirements for new substances, which meant nobody developed any new substances because they wouldn't be able to sell their products so cheaply, which was the origin of REACH. And we had the voluntary commitment on the part of industry to look at the legacy in the next 25 years. Of course, there were thousands of substances that applied to. And we found ourselves in a situation where all these products were already on the market. And so, if you were to proceed as the person who asked the question wanted, I only allow it if it is not damaging, would mean you'd have to take everything off the market and start all over again. And in the current situation, that's not realistic. But the question is nonetheless very justified. I think that's a human trait. You do something first. And it's only afterwards, with hindsight, you realize, maybe that wasn't such a good idea after all. And obviously, we're therefore in a situation now where we've done a lot of damage to the environment. But that's why politically, regulatorily, we need now to take action. And depart from this process of doing something first and then seeing what the effects are. The EPA in the US has taken a different approach, but then they impose such penalties that the producer goes bankrupt and therefore is no longer in a position to actually clean up the damage they cost. But of course, the real problem is, I think, the human trait. Thank you. Now, there's a question from Andreas, which asks about the polluter pays principle, where the polluter actually pays. You talked about 170 billion per year, and is there any plan to establish a fund? So as the producers pay into it as well, but how will the costs basically be covered once we start the cleanup? In Düsseldorf, you can look at online maps to see what the pollution is, and you can look at, say, how much pollution of groundwater reserves are caused by a given industry. But so, what happens then about polluter pays? I think, Teresa, you were first, and then Vicky.
Yeah, okay. I briefly just want to say, talk about comparing it with other chemicals, because when we speak to our investors, they talk about it as the new asbestos. Because, you know, that was a fantastic material that was used widely, and then you're there, you have it, and then you realize it's super problematic. And now you're stuck with it. What are you going to do with it? And then, you know, there are all these costs related, and investors are super scared of it. So, and we see the similar trade when it comes to the waste side of it, because we have fluoropolymers everywhere. We have PFAS everywhere in all products, but eventually they will end up in the waste phase and will have to be treated somehow. And who will want to receive those without charging for it? Because it's really, really costly. They don't even know what to do with it. So I would compare it to asbestos. That's a quite good comparison. What was the other question? Sorry, I forgot.
Polluter pays. Who pays
Polluter
for it?
pays. Yes. I want to start from the other end and just emphasize that what are we talking about when we talk about remediation? It's not like we can clean everything up. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about cleaning up specific materials, specific parts of water that we are about to drink or release somewhere. It's not like anybody is going to clean the rainwater, and nobody is offering to clean my blood, which I know is contaminated. I tested it. So we are talking about very limited pieces of material that is up for remediation, just to start with. And the remediation technologies have huge limitations. It is about reducing the levels, and as was already mentioned, the long chain ones, that might be possible, costly. The short chain ones, much, much more difficult and even more costly. So when you talk about polluter pays, there are talks about creating such a fund and so forth, and there are examples, like for instance in Flanders, where they have actually tried to get 3M to pay at least a reasonable sum. But we're talking about such limited parts of the actual pollution, just to keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Vicky.
Yes, Teresa said some of what I wanted to say on polluter pays, but it is about this is part of, I would say, industry spin against the PFAS proposal, in that industry will say, oh, but if you ban this, it ban these products, ban these substances, it will cost us this amount of money. But in no way do they look in these very official looking studies that they produce and that they send in to the decision makers. They very often say, oh, and by the way, we haven't looked at the environmental and health benefits of the regulations if they were to come in. And this is really what I think the key point about the polluter pays is about what would they be paying. It's not just about business costs, it is about the health and environmental costs as well. And there is a reason why last week Le Monde, who was very public in its work for the Forever Pollution Project, it featured an op-ed from a comment piece from people in civil society, but they also featured a response to the publications from municipalities, who are the ones, the public sector, public authorities, who are the ones that are having to pick up the bill at the moment, whether it's health and environmental costs. And also last week, the water industry also came out in response to the Forever Pollution Project and also begging for action on PFAS, because otherwise the costs will fall on them, whether they're public or private operators. So it is really about, as you say, the polluter pays principle is really fundamental to this. And we have to look at it in the round. When industry says it will cost us some billions, it may do, but there is a whole lot of other costs which are just absolutely not on the being looked at in that scenario.
Vielen Dank. Wir kommen jetzt zum Ende, deswegen
Thank you
machen wir
very
jetzt
much.
eine ganz kleine Runde von Dingen, die
We're
wir besprechen
approaching
wollten.
the
Jeder
end,
wechselt nur
so
eine
a
halbe
very
Minute.
brief with each of you
Ich würde sagen,
getting
das tun wir
30
jetzt, und
seconds
jetzt unsere noch 600
to
Fragen.
look
Also
at the question of
900
what we can do.
Zuhörerinnen.
We've had 600 to 900 people signing into this webinar. So what can they do in person about this? Not in political terms, but in terms of what products they acquire and so on. So what can people do? We'll take the same order as at the beginning. Stefan, 30 seconds on personal empowerment. 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, elections are coming. Ask the candidates to be aware of it and make pledges to deliver. It's largely we need to reach out. It's not just a topic for the Greens. It needs to go everywhere. I think for me, water industry, municipalities, you are right in the center of society where the left, right, up, down, and everybody should be involved in there. Thank you.
Wunderbar. Vicky.
Thank you. Vicky, 30 seconds.
On top of that, I would say get informed. There's a huge amount of information on all of our websites, and please look at the Forever Pollution Project website as well. Lots of information so you can get informed. Look at the map. You can find out about local hotspots that might be in your area. There will be campaign groups active on PFAS, so get involved and join them. And there is a web action as well that is on our website and on ChemTrust and ChemSec's websites as well. There is a lot we can do, and we've talked about how difficult it is as consumers on this, but really I must bring it back to the political action that it, at this point in time, that is really where we can make the most difference.
Dankeschön, Theresa.
Thank you, Theresa.
Yeah, you started out with asking what can you do as a citizen, and I think if you want to avoid buying things that have PFAS in them, you should be wary of all these fantastic claims, because PFAS is a fabulous chemical that can do fantastic things that you don't believe is possible. Whenever you think it's too good to be true, the risk is that it's PFAS. So don't buy it, and accept that there could be a difference when it comes to the functionality. And that's okay, because it's always a trade-off. But then I personally think you should not have to be aware as a customer, as a citizen, but you should be able to rely on your politicians to keep you safe. And right now, they need a push. So please push them. And I will say it again, consumer products are not enough, because that's not the only thing filling your blood with PFAS. It's a nice start, but please ask them to go through with a restriction proposal, follow the democratic process we have in place, and actually restrict all PFAS in all uses. Thank you.
Jutta.
And yeah, Jutta, please. Well, obviously, I can echo what has been said. Put pressure on, write to your representatives, write to the commission, write in person saying, I'm worried about my own and my children's health. Local water suppliers, great, yes. In Germany, the local authority water utilities enjoy the confidence of the local populations. They too should campaign. In Denmark, there's a supermarket chain which has forced its suppliers to supply PFAS-free products, saying, if you don't, you'll be off our lists. End of. So go to your local supermarket, say, look, there's this example. In Denmark, there are supermarkets whose products are PFAS-free. But why aren't your products PFAS-free? What are you doing? So make them responsible too. Thank you. Thank you, Jutta. I think Stefan at the very beginning said, obviously, provide information. We try and do that with Europe Calling. That's my job. That's my message. So pass on to people what you've learned today. And political changes in policy starts in your workplace, when you're sitting around your kitchen table with your friends and your family. It doesn't have to be in any special place, but wherever you are, tell people what you've learned today. and you'll be doing a lot with that. Thank you all very much for taking the time this evening to attend this event in this rather special political week. Next week on Friday, we'll be talking about citizen energy in Germany and Europe, a subject that we're also very interested in and which we've already heard a bit about already. Have a nice evening and see you next time on Europe Calling. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.